Welcome to The Squeal, PIC's Swine Management Podcast, featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. Today, we continue our series titled Priorities in Pig Nutrition with K-State's Dr. Mike Tokash.
Mike Tokash, I'm a professor and swine nutritionist at Kansas State University.
PIC's Dr. Weasley Orlando and Wayne Cast.
Weasley Orlando, swine nutrition here in PIC, leading the nutrition team.
Wayne Cast, I do swine nutrition.
Our specialists share their thoughts on nutrient access, feed mill considerations, and feeder selection.
Let's talk for a second about nutrient access. Particle size, pan coverage, what are some of those impediments on farm that affect access to the best nutrients that we can give that animal? What are some of the things that you guys look at when you walk into a farm?
Feeder space per pig is one that certainly needs to be on the list, and then tied to that is the feeder adjustment, whether they are the pan coverage that's available to the pigs, the placement of the feeders so that they can truly have access to the spaces that are there, the out-of-feed events, and so the storage capacity on the feeders and what that may do to the people in the barn and how they have to manage the runtime on augers and how often people are in the barn to be able to see whether the feeders are actually have feed in them or not. So there's it's around the feed side. There's a lot of those kind of variables that you need to be cognizant of whenever you think about applying a nutrition program in the barn.
Sounds like limitation is people.
Well, it's people and equipment, and sometimes we put equipment in place that makes it harder on the people and makes their job more difficult. And conversely, other times we can provide the right kind of equipment to allow the people to really spend their time looking at the pigs and taking care of the pigs rather than worrying about whether there's going to be feed available that day.
So we spend millions of dollars on research trying to figure out what to put in the damn feeder, and we don't spend very much money on trying to figure out what the best feeder is. That seems to be a disconnect to me. And then the other thing, this pig has changed. He's leaner and he's growing faster and all this, and he gives off more heat, and so ventilation rates have changed. They've changed how much air we need to move in a barn for the same size pigs over the last years, and we'll probably have learned that we can run our barns a little cooler and get better performance. I think there's some management things involved too, beyond the nutrition.
Feed mills. I don't know that I would say, boy, we have figured out how VFDs are best to be handled. We still have options for that. But given that massive influx of requirements at the feed mill that occurred during that point, how confident are we that the feed mills today are providing what we've asked for in the manner at which it needs to be provided?
Yeah, feed mills certainly is one of the biggest constraints that we have in nutrition, because, you know, if you're thinking about what we do in science and nutrition formulated in our diets, we can do our best, but actually each feed mill has different specification, it's different operation. We have people involved as well. So in the end, we need to understand how much variation leaves or are delivered from the feed mills, because we formulate everything or mostly on average, right, Wayne? And the feed mill, only in the mixer, only if you're thinking about the mixer, blending diets, we got at least over than 5%. If you have a below than 10%, I would say that is great number. But I see mostly feed mills that I am aware or visit, when they check, is over than 10%. It means that 10% of variation came from only from the mixer. But we have other points as well involved, right? So I would say that, and actually, it's another science. Feed mill is another science. I mean, certainly is one point that we struggle today in nutrition. We're doing a lot of research in nutrition to understand more about requirement, about how can we feed. I agree with Wayne. We need to put more focus in equipment, but the feed mill is in the middle of this, and certainly we are missing some pieces, even with some improvement. I mean, but I think it's not the same way that we are progressing in nutrition, basic nutrition.
What do you think the improvements are that have occurred over the last 5 years in feed mills? What areas, what operations have you seen where improvements were made?
I think I want to talk a little more about your previous question. Is that one thing I say is that we formulate with a micrometer, and we get to the feed mill and we mark it with a chalk, and then when we get to the farm, we cut it with an axe. And so we just lose some precision. And and the feed mills, you know, the diets have changed. Like a feed mill today uses less phosphate in a month, feed phosphate in a month, than they used to use in a week, or maybe even in a day, because of phytase and distillers and that. And so this auger that was designed to put in the right amount of feed phosphate is way too big today, and so we need to slow it down or make it more efficient or make it less efficient in adding the phosphate, so it adds it slower, or you need to put in a smaller auger. So we've thrown the feed mills a curve in that inclusion rate of these products have changed. And some of our diets, because of the ingredients we're using now, are fluffier. And so we need to be conscious of not overfilling our mixers. And back to Weasley's observations that we need to do mixer studies to understand that we're getting a good mix. But, so you want to see those, when your mixer is full, you want to see those ribbons coming out of that feed. And if you don't, you've overfilled it. And then at a feed mill, we do things to ensure that the feed is as good as we know how to make it. And that would be, we're testing incoming ingredients. We test finished feed. And then another tool that's useful is feed mill accounting. So we made this many tons of feed of these diets, and we were supposed to use this much fat. Is that how much our inventory changed? Those kind of things. So they do a good job, but they need, just like all of us, we need to be monitored and checked and confirmed.
I think that's a great point. It's you trust but verify.
That was very good.
Our feed mills really do try to do a good job, and we've made a lot of advancements on the feed mill side. Sometimes we've made their lives more difficult over the last several years with a lot of the things that Wayne's brought up with inclusion rates and with the number of ingredients that they need to handle. I think they do in general, a really good job of putting things together for us, but we always need to work together with them to make sure that what we think is happening in the mill is truly happening. And not that they are purposely doing things wrong, it's that there's the miscommunication that happens a lot of times when the formula gets sent to a mill without that personal interaction.
Is there a warning sign that when you walk into a feed mill, it says, oh, I need to look at possibly changing feed mills, or this feed mill needs updated? Are there telltale markers?
I would say the first point is when I arrive in one feed mill, and it depends, because we have feed mills with really good everything that we're asking, and we have customers that we stop in a feed mill and you ask the first question, can you show me the samples that you collect, your data of all the raw materials, or your procedures in QA, QC, and they say, I don't have one. And so that is a very, very basic point. I mean, it's a chapter number one. Do you have the procedure for operating one feed mill? It's an industry. It's not about nutrition. It's not like a field or nutrition. We have our way to formulate our diets. The guys in the field, they have the way to raising pigs, but the feed mill, they need to think their operation are an industry, right? They have to be procedements, they have to get a check and everything. I mean, about the mixer, about the palleting, about the reception of products. So It's an industry. It's a production engineering list.
And then large systems that use a lot of toll mills, they will look at performance by mill. You know, they'll look to see, and not only cost, you know, pretty easy to look at cost per ton, but that's really not what they're going to look at. They're going to look, take it further and look at performance, cost effective performance. So you can do that as well as your assays and that. One thing, Mike, that we talked about on the grind, why don't more people grind it that fine? Well, because it won't come out of the bin. And so there's things that they can do there. We can get rid of some of those restrictor plates down there in the boot. That proximity switch at the end of the feed line, we can set that so that auger runs fewer times per day but longer, which ties back to your feeder capacity and some things like that. And we can manage tandem bends better. We shouldn't put feed on top of feed. You know, those three things can help that feed flow and let us capture the value of a finer grind.
And I think where some of these things become issues at times is when you change who's bearing the cost. If in an integrated system, it's pretty easy. The costs are all bore by the same party. When you're in a toll mill situation or you're purchasing feed, it really changes the dynamics on that. And the question, the thing we talked about earlier with the particle size example is that, like Wayne said, is switching from a $2 a pig cost on feed efficiency versus a 10 cent cost difference, but it's easy to say, well, you want to take the 10 cents instead of paying the $2, but the 10 cents is usually borne in that situation by the feed mill and not by the production system. That's where you need to be very clear on what the specifications and on checking it and making sure that everybody's clear on what the goals and parameters are, because you are increasing their cost when you ask them to grind it finer for you.
I'm going to circle back around to a comment Wayne made a bit earlier on equipment research. He was saying feeders. Who's your go-to source for feeder information if you're putting in a new operation? Is it K-State? What is your source when you're looking for the best information on that today?
That's a difficult one because there is no source that regularly tests feeders in the public domain. There's a number of production companies that have tested feeders within their systems, but in all reality, most of the time those tests are relatively limited because they're only testing what they currently have against maybe two or three other options, and those are sometimes not as dynamic of and in-depth studies as what you'd really like over time. But we've got a lot of practical experiences of what we've seen from research trials that both within production systems and universities have done some of that research. So we have kind of a big picture on that. But when it comes down to comparing the fine details on a feeder, there's almost no data on that. We've got the data we have is comparing wet-dry feeders versus dry feeders and number of pigs per space or per feeder hole or the linear dimensions of the feeder or that feeder space. We got a little bit of that, but nowhere near as much data on the feeders as what we have on the diet formulation side.
Does PIC use the same feeders across all your operations? Does
PIC? Hell no. No, there's a zillion kinds of feed. I think Mike hit the nail on the head. There's systems or companies have done research within their system, try to figure out what's best for them, but that knowledge isn't distributed very well, or it's not multiple. It's one versus another almost always, and who knows? Yeah, I think there's opportunity there for the industry to learn, but we don't have a very good approach yet, anyway.
It's not a real simple question at times because you're changing the space availability on that feeder or how many pigs you put on a space, you change how well that feeder performs in a trial in many situations. And we know from a lot of our research, as an example, that a dry feeder, you can change the number of pigs on that space over a pretty wide range and as long as you don't overstock it too heavily, and you can change the adjustment without having as big a range in feed efficiency as you do with a wet dry feeder. And so it's more forgiving on a dry feeder. And so somebody may choose that they're going to put in a dry feeder because more people can get average production with it, if you want to put it that way. But we know that a wet dry feeder, in a lot of experiments, have shown that we can get faster growth rates. If you want to have the best average daily gain, you probably want a wet dry feeder. The problem with a wet dry feeder is that they aren't as forgiving. If you tighten them down too much, you have problems with feed flow and out of feed events. If you open them up too much, you can have higher feed wastage than what you have on that dry feeder. And so you have a bigger range in feed efficiency on a wet dry feeder than what we see with a dry feeder in a lot of the research trials. It goes back to how well you think you can manage those feeders on which one is the right decision for you. And that's just a big picture thing, like a dry versus wet dry feeder.
The topic is priorities in pig nutrition. Today's part two of a three-part series with Drs. Mike Tokash and Weasley Orlando, along with Wayne Cast. You're welcome to share these podcasts widely in your organization. In fact, we encourage it. For PIC, the international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.